Tonight on Arena, we review the week's new film releases, talk to the director of the comedy Eternity, and Joseph O'Connor takes us around Rome. You can text us on 51551. WhatsApp is 0870 32 32 32. You can email arena at rte.ie, and we are on Instagram at rte_arena. But tonight we start with RTE's arts and media correspondent Evelyn O'Rourke. Evelyn, talk us through the developments this evening about Ireland's participation in next year's Eurovision.
Okay, so what's happening is there is a Winter General Assembly happening in Geneva. They have these twice a year for the members of the EBU, but we knew that the big issue this evening was going to be around next year's Eurovision. Just to remind people, it is the 70th anniversary of the Eurovision next year, so it's got particular heft and significance, I suppose, in the history of the Eurovision. Anyway, the members joined, and we knew that they had issued these guidelines a few months or a few weeks ago, saying these are things we're thinking of bringing in. For example, reintroducing juries to the semi-final vote, different pieces, bits and pieces. Also confirming a commitment that they would strengthen monitoring of any kind of telephone or, you know, the different voting systems that are at play, right? So this happened, the vote happened, it really got passed. So those new ideas were passed, and on foot of that then, they said, right, from now on, if you want to take part in the Eurovision, you're welcome to, but you have to say that you'll comply with these rules. But other than that, then you're welcome to participate. This obviously meant that the way was clear for Israel to participate in the competition. On foot of that, and I have to explain, this meeting isn't really being broadcast as such, so we're kind of relying on phone calls and texts and bits and pieces coming through. So it's been a busy evening on the phones trying to get all this. But what we understand is that happened, and then the various broadcasters started issuing their decisions. So first out of the traps was the Netherlands. They came out with a statement saying they were now not going to participate. At this point, times I talk to you now at whatever time it is, 6 minutes past seven, we know that four countries have pulled out. That's Ireland, obviously, we're talking about that in a minute, Spain, Slovenia and the Netherlands. The significance of Spain is important because Spain is one of the big five. It gives more money to the EBU, you know, that always gets through to the final, for example. So that's really important in terms of the lineup to note that. In terms of Ireland, the RTÉ statement is strong. We know that Kevin Backhurst, the DG here at RTÉ, is in Geneva at the meeting. And the statement says that RTÉ feels that Ireland's participation remains unconscionable given the appalling loss of lives in Gaza and the humanitarian crisis there. So a strong statement there confirming that not only are they not going to participate, they're also not going to air it, because obviously that's another decision as well. So that's where we are tonight. We are waiting to hear from Portugal, Belgium and Iceland in particular, because there had been mutterings about them maybe withdrawing. They say that decisions will happen over the coming days. So really we're waiting to see what happens there. So tonight we've got four confirmed pulling out. And then on the other side, Israel has been very strong welcoming it, with the President Isaac Herzog praising the decision to allow the country to compete, and Finland as well confirming they're going to show it. We imagine the countries like Germany are also going to welcome it, because they'd said before that they really wanted to support Israel's ongoing participation. So tonight, talking to you, we've four gone. We've two definitely in, if you know what I mean, and we're waiting to see about the other broadcasters. But it really is an unusual, incredible moment, actually, in the history of the Eurovision. They've never had anything like this before. They claim to be apolitical. They claim that it's a singing competition. And the line is that together in music, you know, and this tonight, obviously, is a really sad chapter, many would say, in the history of it, because we know everybody kind of loves Eurovision in Ireland. There's a bit of a cultural affection for it. Some people love to hate it, but they talk about it. You can't ignore it. So this is where we are this evening.
Do we have any sense, and I know you don't have an answer to this question, as to how this is going to play out over the space of the next few hours, maybe days and even months?
Well, I suppose the big thing was the timing. People kept saying to me, oh, they'll kick this to touch. And I was going, they can't. It's December, the whatever. Like, this competition is coming down the tracks. It's on in May in Vienna. And what happens is, you know, usually we have our Eurosong competition. This year, it was in February, where we pick one of our winners from the Late Late. So the time was really marching in terms of getting acts together. So I kind of was going, there's no way this could be kicked down the road. This has to be decided tonight, because they're very boring logistical bits that have to be done around this. You know, songs have to be picked and acts have to be, you know, the sequence have to be sewn onto the dresses, etc., etc. So really they needed clarity. And in fairness to the hosts in Austria, they were going, well, how many countries do we have? Like, do we have enough to have a semi-final or two semi-finals? They needed clarity as well. So really there was no getting away from this tonight. They've been dancing around a bit on it. Tonight it really had to be called, and that's where we are now. So it's whether more broadcasters join, we just don't know.
Okay, RTÉ's arts and media correspondent, thanks so much for joining us this evening. It is Thursday night on Arena, which means we have three movies up for review. Horseshoe is an Irish comedy drama which won the Best Irish First Feature at the Galway Film Vlad this year. It follows four estranged siblings who reluctantly reunite at the family home for the reading of their late father's will. Amid buried grudges, yoga retreats, awkward teas and hallucinatory twists, family tensions rise until their deceased father mysteriously reappears. On Netflix, George Clooney plays Jay Kelly, a debonair Hollywood actor who faces a midlife crisis. He's keen to spend time with his daughter before she goes to college, and he's upset that she chooses to visit her friends in Europe instead. This encourages Jay to jet to Italy for a career tribute, along with his long-suffering manager Ron, played by Adam Sandler. And in Jafar Panahi's Palme d'Or-winning thriller It Was Just an Accident, Iqbal, a man driving in rural Iran, hits a dog and seeks help at a local garage to repair the damage to his car. The local mechanic, Vahid, a former political prisoner, recognises the voice of his blindfolded interrogator in Iqbal, and what starts as a routine repair job spirals into a tense moral dilemma about revenge, justice and trauma. John McGuire and Dee Malumbi have seen all three and they join me now. We'll start with the Irish film Horseshoe, about the tricky situation left behind when a father dies. John, this is an Irish film that's been making waves. What's it all about?
Well, where there's a will, there's a row. That's what they say, Rick. In Horseshoe, that's what it's all about. It's a debut feature from the directing team, Edwin Milan and Adam O'Keefe, written by O'Keefe, which won the Best First Irish First Feature at the last Galway Film Vlad. Excuse me. The story gathers four estranged siblings in their childhood home on the Sligo coast, up on the Glenif Horseshoe, for an extended bicker over the estate of their recently deceased father, Colm, who's played by Roddy Lawler, and as this foursome attempt to navigate their way to an agreed inheritance and negotiate the effects of bottled grief, long-held grudges resurface between them. There's the eldest brother, Ger, who's played by Jed Murray, the youngest, Evan, who's played by Eric O'Brien. They still live locally or nearby. Ger ended up staying with the father. And then there's the older Niall, played by Neil Fleming, and Cass, played by Carolyn Bracken, who fled that place as soon as they could, and they returned for the reading of the will. But they can all independently still feel the presence of their late father, Colm, Roddy Lawler's character, who might be dead and buried, but his furious ghost literally haunts them. He's like a little leprechaun, hopping with rage and resentments, trying to hang on to his pot of gold, like the spiteful bully that he was in life. And they're dealing with various issues. Niall and Cass are dealing with the disintegration of their marriage. He's taken LSD with a yoga instructor. She's got the more traditional bottle of whiskey. Tortured Ger is trying to form this connection, this maybe connection with the local bar owner, Tony, who's played by Mary Murray. And awkward Evan is hoping that his return to the GAA will distract him from his own personal crisis, his own crisis about his identity. They're all at crossroads in their lives, and what they might be expected to rely on one another. This is an Irish film, so they can't do that. They have to have this simmering rage and resentment that they have between. They have to work out their issues in as well a way as they can. There is nobody to rely on.
Okay, let's take a moment from the film. This is Colm meeting his son Ger on a walk, but he soon realises that Colm isn't quite what he seems. Lola Ruddy as Colm and Jed Murray as his son, with Mary Murray near the end of this clip.
That field is mine.
Was yours.
What's that supposed to mean? What are you doing up here anyway?
Nothing.
It's not nothing. You're up to something.
I'm just walking.
This walk. This is my walk.
You can't own a walk.
Yes, I fucking can.
You'll hear me, boy. Don't touch me. Do you need another lesson, boy?
Ger!
Tony, how are you?
Excellent. Totally. You're talking to yourself?
No. My dad.
I understand.
perfectly normal family dynamic. Dee, how convincing are the interdynamics in between the different members of the family in this film? Does it work for you?
I think it does. Yeah, yeah. I mean, for me, the standout performer in this film is Carolyn Bracken. She was in this horror film, I'm Not Your Mother, a few years ago, which she was absolutely extraordinary in. But her character of Cass is kind of the most interesting, I found anyway, I suppose, the only sister among all of these brothers. She's very kind of witty and sarcastic. She loves a drink. She's teased by her brothers for being wealthy, but then, you know, as the film progresses, there is this desperation to learn about her father's assets. So that suggests, oh, maybe there's something like happening behind the scenes here. She, you know, when she was growing up in this household with Colm and her brothers, there was quite a bit of violence around, we quickly learn. And you can see that her character kind of regresses into childhood. Like at one point, there's a fight between the brothers and she actually hides underneath the table. So it's really interesting to see those aspects of her character come through, and the fact that she's a mother as well. And then you've got Jer, who's kind of the eldest. He's bad tempered. He's stubborn. He has this kind of, you know, bullyish, I suppose, big brother relationship with Evan. They're the only two that have actually stuck around the family home for all of these years. And that family home has been converted into a hostel. And Jer is really kind of obsessed with keeping like this property, I suppose. He really sees it as his home and everything, whereas the other characters are all kind of, I suppose, looking more so to kind of move on and stuff. And then Neil is quite an interesting character as well. He's a single father. He copes with kind of everything by just getting away from the family, a bit like his sister. He's doing scarves and yoga. He has this fitness instructor friend. And then like Eric, who's the youngest of the family, he's just so funny and mild mannered, and he's so desperate to keep the peace. He offers tea so frequently, he'd give Mrs. Doyle a run for his money. And there is good chemistry between the character, between the actors, I think. You do kind of believe in that family dynamic, and it is quite sweet and just very relatable, I suppose, in terms of the whole them butting heads as immediately when they get into a room together.
John, there's a ticking clock on this in terms
there,
of...
There is
of
literally
the
a ticking clock.
Does that create
yeah.
actual tension?
Yeah, the chasms between them only deepen when the solicitor, played by John Connors, reads the will, Colm's will, which stipulates that they have 24 hours to agree between them what happens to the house and its contents, or he's going to gift it to the state. And so they have to sit down like adults and figure it out, something that they individually and collectively seem really resistant to and unable to do. But this is the thing about the Horseshoe, is that there's a nagging sense, even though I couldn't cite you a title, there's a nagging sense throughout the film that I've seen this film before, maybe a dozen times. It feels, and this is not necessarily a criticism, but it feels very much like a mid-range Irish film. And these are first-time feature filmmakers, first-time feature scriptwriters. And I just wanted something that I had not seen before or didn't feel like I'd seen before. But that familiarity and predictability is lessened, like Dee says, by a really quite a fine cast and well-judged moments of authentic humour. And that sense of place is really well communicated, particularly the landscape photography and a really beautiful score from Anna Malarkey, which makes great use of a couple of songs from John Francis Flynn. So, one way or the other, you know, I wanted to like it more than I did.
Let's try and quantify that with stars.
Two for me, I'm afraid. I wanted to like it, like I say, I wanted to like it more than I ended up doing.
And D for you?
Yeah, I'd add to what John was saying there about, yeah, the absolutely gorgeous scenic shots of Sligo and Leitrim really do make the film. I will kind of emphasise in the film's defense, it was kind of an experimentation whereby they had the cast before they actually had the script, and the latter grew from the form, which I thought was quite interesting. It doesn't always work, but I thought that those creative circumstances behind it are admirable. So I'm going to give this 3 stars.
Okay, we'll move on to Noah Baumbach's new film, Jay Kelly. George Clooney has teamed up with him to play a character who sounds remarkably like George Clooney. Dee, set the scene in Jay Kelly for us.
Yeah, I mean, George Clooney really does love a role that involves a little bit of introspection, doesn't he? So in this film, he plays Jay Kelly, who is a Hollywood star. Essentially, what happens is he meets a former acting school colleague at a funeral. This conversation kind of results in Jay Kelly going through something of a crisis, and he decides to follow his teenage or kind of college graduate, I suppose, daughter on a trip across Europe with his publicity team in tow, which, as you can imagine, only has great consequences.
OK, we're going to play a clip here. This is Jay and Ron on a train in Italy. They're both reflecting on where their lives are.
Suddenly remembering things I haven't thought about in a long time.
Our family's losing it at home.
It's like a movie where I'm playing myself or watching myself.
I'm sorry, you gotta go again. I didn't hear a word you said.
I said I'm suddenly remembering things. And what is that?
Memory?
Well, yes.
Maybe your memory's trying to tell you something about your present.
Like what?
I don't know. I'm tired.
I just had a fight with Daisy.
I wish I was there to help
you. What'd you say? What?
What? Nothing. I'm just tired.
I just wish I already spent more time with her. I was always at work.
Well, I always negotiated flights on the weekends for you to go home and see the kids.
It's very difficult. What are you getting at?
I'm just saying Ben, for instance, flies home every weekend from the show to see his family.
Ben Alcock.
I'm not comparing
him. It's hard not to feel like you
are. I'm just saying these are the decisions we make.
John, there's a great cast here, and Clooney is playing a handsome movie star, playing a handsome movie star who has an identity crisis and reflects on his own life. Is it all a little bit too close for comfort?
We're dealing in the terms of metafiction here, Rick, and I suppose the central tension in the film is the price of fame. What do famous people give up in order to be famous and to maintain a fame? Clooney's character, Jay Kelly, is just about to turn 60, and he comes to realise that he's traded his relationships with his daughters, with the people who work for him and his closest friends, for these decades of success that he's enjoyed. And he says at one point, Jay Kelly says, all my memories are movies. And by that, he means that everything that's significant in his life, he associates with the film that he was working on at the time. And Baumbach and his co-writer, who's Emily Mortimer, the actor Emily Mortimer, who plays a small cameo here, the gimmick, I suppose, if you like, is that they bring that soul searching to life by filming those memories as these short little sharp vignettes that deliver this lonely and remorseful and very charming and handsome actor into his own past and into his own memories. Some of them work really well and some of them do not. And there's a sense that we're getting, like you say, there is a great cast, but there's another entirely a shadow cast of cameos of people who literally get 2 minutes of screen time. And it starts to feel a little bit, I'm reaching for the word. It starts to feel a little gimmicky, I suppose. It starts to feel like this is kind of almost a fake. It is fake. Of course it's fake, but it starts to feel really plastic and artificial.
What did you think, Dee? Does this work for you in any way?
I did find it entertaining. Like, the film is quite zippy. It's dominated by, you know, sharp, chatty dialogue, which we, you know, long associated with Noah Baumbach as a director and a writer. And I liked the whole idea behind it on, you know, reflecting on life and the roads not taken and stuff. But yeah, I probably second a lot of what John was saying. And as well, for me, I think that in the tragedy of Jay Kelly, the whole idea that this character has given up so much to become an actor, he feels so sorry for himself that there is no room left for the audience to need to feel sorry for him.
Are you playing the world's smallest violin here?
Exactly, yeah. He's so self-pitying.
Quite a bit of that, Dee. And there's the central sequence is this kind of Fellini-esque screwball centerpiece, which is this long, chaotic journey on an Italian train where the ordinary passengers, the ordinary people, gasp in astonishment to have this star in their midst, while Jay and Adam Sandler's Ron, who's his longtime manager, it's really well played. They deal with this escalating series of complications. And it's so slick and sentimental that it feels at times like one of Clooney's coffee ads. That's what it starts to feel like, that the coffee brand that he advertises. And it just takes you out, really, of what the kind of spiky and difficult themes that they're trying to address, but it feels superficial and slick.
Okay, give me some stars on this.
Two again. I wasn't buying any of this for a minute, Rick.
Did you buy any more of it, Dee?
I liked it a bit more. I'd give it 3 stars. It's nice and enjoyable. There's a likeable cast, bittersweet story, but there's just not a lot to cling to once the final credits roll.
Okay, finally this evening to the Iranian film It Was Just an Accident. It won big at Cannes earlier this year. John Jafarpanahi, he's an award-winning Iranian filmmaker.
Yep.
His own life wife is a compelling story in and of itself.
Yeah, veteran Iranian filmmaker who's been arrested, imprisoned, denounced as a dissident by the Iranian regime on multiple occasions, most recently last Tuesday when he was sentenced in absentia to a year in prison. His last prison sentence ended when he's now 67 years of age. He went on hunger strike. And this, It Was Just an Accident, is his most bluntly political film yet, an incredibly courageous film, I suppose, that denounces an authoritarian regime, its cruel practices, the corruption that it spreads throughout the community. But it is also a gripping thriller. There's pitch black comedy here, and it's a razor sharp study of people traumatized, not just by individual acts of violence, but by an entire society of violence, repression and control. And it's really, really good, Rick. This is a super film that won the Palme d'Or at the last Cannes. It opens with an unfortunate meeting of a car bumper and a stray dog. The man that owns the car is played by Ebrahim Azizi. He's driving at night. He pulls into a mechanic's garage owned by Vahid, played by Vahid Mobasseri, who is nicknamed Jughead because of his habit of holding his painful kidneys with one arm like a jug handle, like a cup. And the driver has a disability too. He has this limp from a prosthetic leg, and Vahid is horrified to realize that he recognizes this man as Peg Leg, the secret police interrogator who had tortured him years before, 4 years. So he follows him, lies in wait, kidnaps him, which is a rash act. The man pleads his innocence, says he has nothing to do with it, and Vahid, who is unsure, can't make an absolutely positive identification, goes to a friend who sends him to somebody else, who sends him to somebody else, and soon you have this gathering of people. The guy is in a box in the back of a van, and he has this group of people around him, and they're driving around over a day and a night to find out, what are we going to do? How we've put ourselves in this situation for vengeance or revenge or payback or whatever it might be. But how do we actually do it? How do we do it and not get caught?
Dee, there's an ominous tone in this from fairly early on, and it just gets darker, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a really kind of interesting film because there is that darkness there, but there is also kind of these strangely comical moments, which is what really keeps you immersed in this film. And you're constantly intrigued from, you know, the context behind the kidnapping that's revealed, and as more and more individuals get involved in it. I think that the director, Jafar Pahani, a lot of his work is kind of associated with defiance, and even I would argue in terms of if you were trying to put this film into a genre, it's also defiant. There are those dark comedy elements to it, and yet there's the political context, which is very serious and would be straight up drama. The film has been widely described as a thriller, and it almost has this kind of revenge narrative aspect to it. But at the same time, it's a very clumsy revenge narrative because none of the characters know whether this is really the man that they're after, the man that tortured them years and years ago. So I found all these elements of it really kind of interesting. There's great unrest in this. There's anger, there's trauma. The emotion in this film is so raw. So I found it a really fascinating watch, I have to say, from start to finish. And the sight of one of the characters, Goli, who's actually a bride, she's been used in a lot of the promotional materials for her, whether she's kind of pushing the car with all of the male, her fellow male characters, or sitting in the van absolutely exhausted as the group kind of sits and tries to figure out their next steps. Those kind of images, again, they're so strange, so striking, and so defiant in terms of, like, you would associate this with the glamorous bride, but she's hardly that, you know?
Okay, we're going to go for stars on this from both of you. Dee?
I give it 4 stars. It's a really, really strong film. I think it's only getting a limited cinema release, but I do urge people to go seek it out. It's one of the most unique films to emerge, not only this year, but in many recent years.
Okay, John?
The sentencing judge that sentenced Pahani this week claimed that he had engaged in propaganda activities against the system, which to my mind is a working definition of an unmissable film. You have to go and see it. They should put that on the poster as a 5-star review for me. I love this film. It's astonishing.
Okay, John McGuire, Dee Malumbi, thank you for joining me. Horseshoe and It Was Just an Accident open in cinemas this weekend, and Jay Kelly lands on Netflix tomorrow. David Frayne is a filmmaker who's quickly established himself as one of the most distinct and versatile voices in Irish cinema today. A graduate of UCD, he first grabbed the industry's attention with his 2017 debut feature, The Cured, a smart political twist on the zombie genre that starred Elliot Page. But he's probably best known as the writer and director of the 2020 film Dating Amber, a very Irish comedy set in 1990s Kildare. It didn't just win over critics, it captured hearts with its warmth, humour and beautifully authentic portrayal of platonic love. Now, David is taking the leap to the global stage with his latest film, Eternity, produced by the uber-cool powerhouse that is A24. This high-concept romantic comedy stars Miles Teller, Elizabeth Olsen and Callum Turner. It imagines an afterlife where the newly deceased Olsen has just 1 week to choose who she wants to spend forever with, a premise that allows him to channel the spirit of his cinematic idols like Billy Wilder and Powell and Pressburger. And David Frayne, you're very welcome to Arena this evening.
Thank you so much. That's a nice intro.
Before I get into Eternity, the last film, Dating Amber, it was very beloved. It was that lovely, intimate Irish coming-of-age story. Eternity is obviously a much bigger production on a different scale, with global stars in it. So was there a bit of a shock to the system to making that leap?
I mean, I was worried beforehand because it was a big leap up in budget and obviously the huge stars in it. But when it got down to making it, it felt very similar to making Dating Amber. It was, you know, we were very nimble. We approached it like an indie. Everyone just mucked in. We shot it in Canada. Canadian crews are very similar to Irish crews in how they approach things. So once I got over the shock of it all, it felt incredibly, incredibly similar to making Dating Amber. And I had my Irish cinematographer who did Dating Amber with me, which was lovely as well. So, it was alarmingly close.
I've briefly outlined the story, but maybe give us a little greater sense of where we are at the start of the film.
I mean, it's an older couple who die very close together, and Elizabeth Olsen's character, Joan, she meets her husband who just died by choking on a pretzel, but also her first love who died tragically at war 67 years ago, and she has to make the decision as to who she wants to spend eternity with. And that's kind of what really struck me by the premise, the idea of choosing between first great love and last great love just felt like a great idea for a romantic comedy. One of those ideas you're surprised hadn't been done before, and it got the opportunity to create a huge afterlife around that, which has always been my dream.
I want to take something from the film before we go any further. Yeah. So this is Elizabeth Olsen as Joan spotting her first love, Luke, played by Callum Turner. Miles Teller is Joan's husband, Larry, and he's feeling the pressure a bit.
Hey, what's going on, guy? This was my bartender. I guess I forgot to pay the tab. I didn't realize there'd be a tab. Nobody gave me any money.
No way.
Sorry, I forgot to ask your name. What's your name again?
I'm Luke.
This is Luke. He's my bartender.
John.
Oh, no.
I never dreamt you this clearly.
You're exactly how I dreamt you.
Ooh. Hard luck, Larry.
No, Luke had a mustache.
Yeah, well, Joni hated it, so I shave it off every morning, hoping she's gonna show up.
Oh my God, how romantic.
And you did.
Okay, sweetie. Okay.
Oh.
What are you doing?
Larry.
Okay, sweetie.
All right.
Let's go.
Who's this guy?
The second husband.
I prefer current husband.
The current husband.
I've read that you had doubts initially that Hollywood producers would trust a film of this scope and this scale to, in your own words, a little Irish indie filmmaker.
Yeah.
So tell me about the moment where you first thought, oh, hang on a second, okay, they can trust me with this.
I mean, we worked really hard in the script and I did this very detailed lookbook, and it was just so happened that we were about to go out with it and trying to figure out if somebody would take a chance on me, and A24 were slipped the script by our agent. We shared the same agent, myself and Pat, the co-writer, and they just flipped for it and went for it. And I thought they wouldn't entrust it with me, but they never questioned it. They loved the script. They loved kind of my lookbook and the vision for the film, and at no point doubted me, which was really bizarre. I kept for the year in development with them, I just kept waiting for them to fire me or an actor to say, let's go out to a bigger director. But yeah, it was lovely. And I think they had all seen Dating Amber and they all loved that. And I think even though it's a much smaller film, I think it showed the comedy and drama in the way that we wanted Eternity to hit. So yeah, it was lovely. I mean, it wasn't until we'd really wrapped it I kind of fully believed I wouldn't get fired though.
Talk to me about the look of the film. Yeah. Most of it is set in the Junction, which is this sort of convention centre, yeah. sort of hotel, sort of train yeah. station, where everybody goes after they've died. Given your background in production design at UCD, how hands-on were you with the actual, you know, the building of yeah. all of the minutiae of that world?
I worked really closely with our incredible designer, Zazu, but I always imagined it and wrote it into the script as being a kind of a brutalist structure. The idea that the powers that be redesigned recently, which for them was the 60s, when brutalism was kind of the idea of utopia. So it was always this weird mashup between the Barbican in London and the Moriyama Library in Toronto. And that was always our go-to when we were designing it. And then surrounded by these kind of fake painted backdrops, these scenic bluffs, as if you're walking in the back lot of a film set, this kind of really artificial idea of heaven. So that was all written into the script, and we hewed really clearly closely to that. But I think what we wanted to do in the design then was making sure that it made sense, that that it worked, that it had a day and night, it had a bureaucracy, that it kind of it had a hierarchy, and that you could see how everything connected and there was a chaos to it that made sense for the characters. So yeah, it was a really fun collaborative process. But yeah, I kind of had a very clear idea of how I wanted it to look from the writing process.
That internal logic is an important yeah. one in a film like this, isn't it? Because people will unpick the idea of, well, okay, you've established this world, you've established what the rules are and how you're supposed to do this. But if you vary from that, then it almost means people will cease to believe in the story you're trying to tell.
Yeah, I think it's really important that you, like, we didn't want to ever kind of get bogged down an exposition. We wanted to make sure this stayed character focused throughout and you never get lost in the rules. But that only works if the rules are really clearly laid out or really clearly worked out. I think there's a sense, and it's with great writing as well, that an audience needs to believe that the author understands the rules. They don't need to understand the rules, but they need to know you're in safe hands. So we spent a lot of time working out the logic. Myself and Pat worked out the science of the world, and we actually had one or two speeches in the film that Devine gave that we ended up just leaving out because they weren't needed, but it was kind of explaining more of the rules, but it just felt unnecessary. I think you could feel you were in safe hands. But yeah, we worked it out like really in real detail, and how everything works and even how the time of day works in this place.
In terms of your cast then, so yeah. you've got Elizabeth Olsen and Miles Teller in particular, they're both quite known for their dramatic chops,
yeah.
for everything from WandaVision to Whiplash. Yeah. There's a little comedy in those things, but for both of them, did you set out here when you were casting them to go, I'm going to prove that these guys can do this kind of comedy?
I mean, I think I knew they could. You can even just tell from interviews that they had that comedic bone and hadn't really stretched it fully. So, and it's really exciting as a director to have actors do something they haven't fully done before. But I knew they would be able to do it. I didn't know quite how brilliant they'd be at it. Like, they're so hilarious in this film. And Callum as well. Like, they're so funny, and they're such good ad-libbers. I had full faith they could do it. I mean, it's always surprising how surprising it is that they're brilliant at it.
One of the things that struck me most when I was watching the film was that in most love triangle rom-coms like this, if that's what you want to call
yeah.
it, there's usually an obvious like wrong choice.
Yeah.
And you were adamant there shouldn't be a bad guy here, and there yeah. isn't. So we swing back and forth between Miles Teller and Callum Turner in terms of who we think is the best choice as an audience. How do you keep that balance going back and forth?
I mean, I think it was just about making sure both men are fully fleshed out. And they both have their flaws, but they're both true loves. They're both great loves. They just represent this character, Joan, at different times in her life. And I think it's really, like, I love that an audience might fight over who she chose and kind of be team Luke and be team Larry, which doesn't matter as long as you're always team Joan. But yeah, I think it's really, the film doesn't have stakes if you don't allow somebody to be heartbroken. And it's not really a big dilemma for Joan if there's a very clear front runner or a very clear good guy or a bad guy. So it was really important to us that we make it a difficult decision for her. We make it a really, really excruciating decision for her. And also that it's not a binary choice. She can go on her own. Like, she doesn't have to choose either man. I think that's really, really important.
In terms of influences here, yeah. We've talked about Powell and Pressburger's A Matter of Life and Death in particular. You can see that in certain moments of the film.
Yeah.
Things like The Truman Show as well. What were the influences, the other ones that you kind of wanted to at least kind of nod to in this film?
I mean, there's a lot. I think like Playtime, the Tati film, was a huge influence. Particularly me and Cecilia, our designer, watched that over and over again, just on how they do the mechanics of how that place, that weird space works, is how. And there's a great documentary by Agnes Varda called Côte de la Côte, which is a half an hour documentary about a beach. And I think our beach is pretty much that. Like, there's some shots that are like just frame by frame that as an homage. And The Graduate was massive. The palette and tone of The Graduate was a huge reference for our Junction and our afterlife and the costuming of Larry's character. So a lot of 1960s stuff, even though I think a lot of the tonal references come from Billy Wilder and the more black and white films of that those eras and Preston Sturges, I think the visual references come really from the 60s. And also like Umbrellas of Cherbourg and The Young Girls of Rochefort, of course, as well. So yeah, really strong, powerful colours.
You've thrown in all the genuine greats in there.
You try. Yeah, yeah. Just the very little comparison. But yeah, I think there's a lot of, like, I think there's a grittiness to those films. There's like a dirt to those films, even though they're really powerful and punchy. You can feel the grain, you can feel the texture. They don't feel too pristine. And we really wanted to make this world feel kind of a little lived in.
I have to talk about Divine Joy Randolph and John Early. They're the two afterlife coordinators that are assigned, and they come very close to stealing the entire film.
They really do. They were always written as strong parts, like the kind of Greek chorus in the film that kind of help guide the characters and explain things. But they're just so incredible in those roles. Like, you could easily just watch their film, like their own film, and I'd happily write that. And yeah, they're incredibly funny, and also when they need to be, quite moving and touching. And I loved writing for them so much. I think we were shooting with them and I ended up writing additionals. There's one scene where the two of them are on their own just walking through this junction as it wakes up in the morning and people are hoovering. I wrote that, I think, a day beforehand, just because I loved working with them so much, and I just wanted a scene where it was just them alone questioning their roles in this place, because I felt like they deserved it. They deserved that moment. Yeah, they're incredibly watchable. Like, they do steal so many scenes. They're incredibly watchable and brilliant, and also just the loveliest people.
You're adapting Dating Amber for the stage, if I have that right. Like, how does that feel, returning to that story and trying to put it on stage after spending time in this completely different high concept, big budget world?
It's been lovely. It's been it came out of left field. It came as an opportunity from a director, Des, and Landmark. And I've had a really good time. Like, I've really, it's my first time writing for the stage, and I've loved it. I found it actually really liberating, just kind of luxuriating in scenes. Like, film's all about getting in late and leaving early, but with theatre, it's like, just hang around for a bit, write a bit more dialogue. And it's been really fun. And I love Dating Amber, and I love that story so much, and getting to revisit it and kind of just almost trying to embellish it and make it deeper and funnier has been really amazing. And there's an incredible musician, Katie Richardson, writing the music, and she's so brilliant, and the music is actual earworm, so, which I've no control over, but it's genius. So yeah, it's been really nice.
David Frayn, it's been great to talk to you, and Eternity is an absolute joy of a film. It goes on general release in cinemas this weekend.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. Next Wednesday, the 10th of December, the Italian Cultural Institute Dublin plays host to an evening of Irish and Italian music from Shannos to Verdi, and a public interview with author Joseph O'Connor. The Eternal City of Rome has been a popular destination for artists, filmmakers, writers and tourists alike for centuries, but Joseph has added layers of meaning and interest for Irish visitors with two novels there set during World War II. My Father's House and The Ghosts of Rome are part of a trilogy telling the story of Monsignor Hugh O'Flaherty and a whole host of friends who took active part in the resistance during World War II. And I'm delighted that Joseph O'Connor is on the line now. Joseph, you won the On Post Listener's Choice Award last week for The Ghosts of Rome at the Irish Book Awards. How does it feel when you hear your name on a night like that?
Good to talk to you, Rick. I am conscious this is the first time I've been on Arena since Sean left us. So if I can just take one moment to send thoughts to all of you at the programme and to his RTE colleagues, and especially, of course, to Sean's family. The prize night was lovely. I mean, it's lovely to be nominated. It's lovely to go along. It's like the office party for the Irish book world. It was a great night, made very special for us at University of Limerick, where I teach, because I was shortlisted and our former student on our MA in creative writing, Gráinne O'Brien, won the award in her category, Young Adult Fiction, for her fantastic novel, Solo. So it was a great old night, and I don't drink during the week anymore, but I may have bent the rules a bit that night, Rick. May have been a Prosecco or two.
Sometimes you have to. We knew about Monsignor Hugh O'Flaherty, if only people had seen the 1983 film The Scarlet and the Black. He's played by Gregory Peck in that. But there were other Irish people as well, like Delia Kiernan, famous singer in her day, who were all part of the escape line as well, weren't they?
Yes, well, I mean, thousands of people were part of it, but I suppose the central nucleus of it, which is run by Hugh, with six or seven others, people of different faith backgrounds from his and different political outlooks and all of that. But one of his great helpers was Delia Murphy, the folk singer, who John Kelly of RTE said to me a while ago when we were chatting about her, the nearest thing 1940s Ireland had to a pop star, in that she didn't just sing ballad sessions in pubs, she did international tours and made albums and all of that. She was married to a man called Tom Kiernan, who was made Ireland's ambassador to the Vatican. So she went to Rome in that role as his spouse. And, you know, Ireland was neutral in the Second World War. And strictly speaking, she would have been seen by the Dublin authorities as that she shouldn't be involved in this escape line. But nevertheless, her enormous personal courage and idealism took over. So it was she and Hugh and many, many Irish people were involved, and they may have saved 7,000 lives in the course of the 10-month Nazi occupation of Rome. So that's the story that's told in My Father's House and The Ghosts of Rome, and I'm sure it'll come up at our event in the Italian Cultural Institute next week, yeah. Which I'm looking forward to very much.
Talk to me about Rome itself. How well did you know the city pre-researching and writing the first book in the series?
I didn't know it at all, Rick. I was there many, many years ago on a school trip, but until I started writing My Father's House, I hadn't spent any time there. And so my wife, Anne-Marie, and I started to go 4 or 5 years ago, and we just absolutely fell for it. It's just an immensely fascinating place, multi-layered, great beauty everywhere you turn. You go into a chapel and there's a Caravaggio. You walk past the building where Puccini's Tosca is set, the house where John Keats lived, and on. So for all of your listeners, the people who are into the arts, it's an amazing city, but it does have this other history, which is of violence and fascist occupation and then, you know, resistance and heroism. So I was very interested in that. And then even physically, Rick, there's an enormous amount of Rome that's actually below the surface. You know, there's a lot of scenes in My Father's House and The Ghost of Rome set in the underground of Rome. It has many, many miles of underground passageways and catacombs and crypts and abandoned underground places of one kind or another. And of course, it was one of the things that Hugh had to his great advantage in his battle to outwit the Gestapo, is that he knew all of these places. He was very familiar with them. So he could move fugitives around Rome without the occupying forces knowing what he was doing. So Rome has the beautiful face that it presents to the world, but it also has this hidden side. And so that adds a kind of gothic drama that's available for the storyteller, you know, so it makes it very attractive.
Yeah, I thought we might pick out a couple of locations, and given that time that you've spent in Rome, you'd be well placed to take us on a little tour of some of those that are of particular Irish interest. Tell me about the Villa Spada. It's the neighbourhood that Hugh O'Flaherty knew quite well.
Yeah, well, Villa Spada is the Irish embassy to Italy, and some people say it's the most beautiful of all Ireland's embassies. It's a great place to start any stroll around Irish Rome, because it's a beautiful location and it's quieter than the city. And Hugh, you know, knew the ambassador and his wife, as I've said, and many Irish ambassadors have lived there since. A really beautiful place, very near the church of San Pietro in Montorio, a couple of minutes away, which is an amazing panoramic view of Rome. But that's the final resting place of the Irish chieftains, Rory O'Donnell, the former king of Tyrconnell, and Hugh O'Neill. So everywhere you turn in Rome, there is that sort of footprint of the Irish past.
In terms of Hugh O'Neill, the Earl of Tyrone, and Rory O'Connell of Tyrconnell, is it moving in some way to see their names and their birthplaces on the slab of the floor of a chapel in a foreign city?
Well, I suppose what's remarkable is that Irish people have been visiting Rome for well over 1,000 years. I mean, there's stories of Brian Boru's family visiting Rome. I think Brian Boru's father died in Rome and is buried in Rome. And it is everywhere you turn, like the beautiful church of San Clemente a Laterano, which would be a lot of people's favourite Roman church. A very old history with Ireland. There's the monastery and college of Sant Isidro, which is in the Ludovisi district, founded by Luke Wadding from Waterford in 1625. It became a hugely important cultural and artistic centre for Irish studies in Europe. Right up to the present day, I mean, there's a really beautiful small art gallery in Rome, the Galleria Lorcan O'Neill, run by a man from Ballinrobe, who's the brother of Rory O'Neill, Anthony Bliss, and it's a fabulous small private gallery. James Joyce worked in Rome in the bank of Nast, Alb and Schumacher on the corner of Via del Corso. And if you'd walked in there on a certain date in 1906, I think it was, the surly fella behind the counter cashing your traveller's checks might have been James Joyce. So we did leave our imprint there, and it's a lovely thing to notice that when you're wandering around this gorgeous city of cultural pleasures.
The College of Sant Isidoro is a really interesting one, isn't it? Because there's an image of St. Brigid there with the inscription in Irish.
Yeah, so the first thing you see as you approach this church is the exterior mural of St. Brigid. Beside her, big mural of St. Patrick, and the inscriptions are in Irish. And I believe that it may be the first time that the Irish language featured in an artwork on the European mainland. And I think it was Luke Wadding's way of saying to Rome, you know, we're here and this is going to be a very important college and we're going to study the classics and scriptural writings, but we're also going to study our own culture and make it part of the European mainstream. So there's an interesting echo in the air. There's something going on at the moment about the Irish language, and I can feel that, and I hear my own students and my two sons who are in their 20s talking about it. But it's very interesting to see the roots hundreds and hundreds of years ago over in Rome, when Irish scholars took the language and said, look, this is worthy of study. You know, this is a beautiful language, the oldest vernacular language in Europe, and we're going to do everything that we can to save it. So some of that went on through Luke Wadding's work in Rome. Really remarkable man.
Why do you think there is that resurgence happening at the moment in terms of both Irish history, the Irish language, Irish culture? What do you see in that?
Well, I think what's happening with the language is that we're finally, if I may say so, and I mean no disrespect to anybody, beginning to grow up about it. And there's a sense that this is a very rich language that's full of pleasures and opportunities, not something that we have to be forced to learn, that comes with a whole set of ideological baggage. I was very struck by a remark that President Connolly made during her campaign, when she said, it's a great thing to know Irish because it's a completely different way of looking at the world. And of course, it is, like Tobron Orum, the emotions are on you, and even the family relationships and love relationships, it's a far Kayla and a ban Kayla rather than a husband or a wife. And I think it's a good moment for us. And it's maybe related, Rick, to the disappearance of other certainties. I mean, I think we're in a period of intense change in Ireland. And I think part of that does seem to be people having another look at this beautiful language and saying, you know, I wonder, will I put some heart into that, as opposed to just trying to constantly learn the Moke and Eloch? So it's very exciting. And then I think what's happening in culture, and particularly in literature, is just this flowering, this amazing renaissance, which has been fed by new voices, more women than have ever been published before, voices from other perspectives, at a very healthy Irish publishing scene, work that's been done by the Arts Council Literature Department. So it's really a very exciting generation of younger Irish writers, and it's lovely to watch that and to see it and to be part of it in my job teaching at the University of Limerick, where I lead the creative writing program. So it's you know, I think in terms of Irish writing, it would be hard to think of a better or healthier time than the one we're going through at the moment. So it's great stuff.
How does it feel to be, if you don't mind me saying so, one of the elder statesmen of that scene?
Oh, it feels like something to be resisted. No, look, it's like I set out to write when I was 17, and it's all I ever wanted to do. And I just consider I'm incredibly blessed to have been allowed to do it for so long, and now to be allowed to teach it. You know, I have very close friendships with the Irish writers of my own age. And it was very collegial and very encouraging, and we all helped each other along. And it's lovely to see that happening now with the younger writers as well. But I'm still here, Rick. You know, I'm not in my dotage just yet. But I'm certainly looking forward to my dotage, and I won't have to work so hard writing books.
Well, in terms of still being here, my father's house and the ghosts of Rome, they're part of a trilogy. So where are you with novel number 3? How's that going?
So I have reached an exciting moment with it, where I have finished the penultimate draft. So I'm going to take a couple of days off over Christmas and January. I'm going to do the last draft, and I'm going to hand it in at the end of January and hope that it's okay. But I think it is. I'm quite excited about it. I think it's quite good. And at the moment, it's called Lost Waters. Now, that might change, but the working title is Lost Waters, and the central character in it is a guy who's in my father's house and the ghosts of Rome, called John May. He's a Cockney butler at the British Embassy in Rome. So it'll have all the same characters. Hugh O'Flaherty will be in it. Delia Murphy will be in it. But it's John May's perspective. And I might even read a little bit of it for the first time, if people would like to come along to the event, the Cultural Institute, next Wednesday, the 10th of December at 6 p.m. You book on Eventbrite. They can come along and hear me talking to Frank McNally, and I might read a minute or two of the new book as well.
That is an absolutely perfect sales job, much better than one than I could have done. Tell me, do you know when that book is going to be in bookshops?
Yes, it's in January 2027. So it's, you know, it takes a while. But the paperback of The Ghosts of Rome will be out in the bookshops in Ireland before Christmas, I think maybe around the 11th of December. And that's coming out soon. And sure, while we're chatting, Rick, I will mention that the final, the competition for the, I think it's Best Irish Book of the Year, will be televised on the night of December the 11th at 10:15 on RTE television. Six books that made it into the final, including my own, and including Gráinne O'Brien's, who I mentioned earlier, including Solo by Gráinne O'Brien. So that will be a good laugh. 10:15, December the 11th.
That means that UL has...
I think I've plugged everything.
UL has a double bet on that night. And congratulations to both of you for making that last grouping. Joseph O'Connor, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so many for joining us tonight on Arena.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you.
Joseph O'Connor is in conversation, as he said, with Frank McNally at the Italian Cultural Institute in Dublin at 6 p.m. on the 10th of December. You can book via the Eventbrite website. My Father's House and The Ghosts of Rome are published by Vintage. That is it for tonight's Arena, produced by Sinead Egan. Paula Shields was our researcher. Ollie Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator, and sound supervision tonight by Niall McMonagle. I'll talk to you tomorrow night. We'll have new TV, including Watson and the Doctor Who spin-off, The War Between the Land and Sea. We'll be reviewing those and recommending albums that you might have missed in 2025. John Creedon is next. I'll talk to you tomorrow.